Welcome to this podcast from the Medical Journal of Australia. My name is Sam Hunt, the MJA's news and online editor. Today we are discussing iron deficiency in the general Australian population, including causes and symptoms, and investigations and treatment options. This podcast is sponsored by Viatris. The views expressed in this podcast belong to the guest speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Viatris. My special guest is Professor Arumugan Manoharan, a specialist physician in clinical haematology at St George Private Hospital in Sydney, and a clinical professor at the Graduate School of Medicine at the University of Wollongong. Professor Manoharan, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure, Sam. Thank you for inviting me.
Professor Manoharan, before we dive into iron deficiency and the causes, can you please tell me a little bit about your background and your passion for this topic?
Thank you, Sam. I'm a clinical hematologist physician. I'm attached to both the College of Physicians and the College of Pathologists, although I have been mainly a practicing clinical hematologist. I was director of clinical hematology at St. George Hospital from 1982 to 2008. Since 2008, I'm mostly in specialist consulting practice, do teaching for the medical school at University of Wollongong. I see a whole variety of patients with hematological problems, both malignant and non-malignant. In the latter group, one of the common things that patients are referred to me are those with iron deficiency state with or without anemia. So I was happy to take part in this educational program because I see a fair number of these people in my practice.
And turning now to iron deficiency, Professor Manoharan, can you please give me an idea of what you're seeing across the general population in terms of iron deficiency and anemia?
Iron deficiency state with or without anemia is the most common clinical problem all over the world. Some studies have come up with a figure of 15% of the world population being iron deficient. That's more than 1 billion people around the world. In a developed country like Australia, it is not that common, but it is still common enough for the medical practitioners in all areas to be aware of and to look for. The iron deficiency state occurs in all age groups, starting from childhood, teenage girls, women between the ages of 15 and 45, in menopausal women and men of any age group. People in all specialties, particularly in general practice, they would see a cross-section of people from all age groups coming to them with iron deficiency state. And one of the common things in all age groups is the dietary habits of the individual. For example, if they are vegetarians or they have unhealthy eating habits, that can also be a contributing factor for iron deficiency state. So I think the patients usually will present to the medical practitioners complaining of tiredness, fatigue, and generally not coping with the day-to-day demands, whether housewives looking after family or even in the work situation, they may be struggling to cope with the demands of the work. So I think tiredness and fatigue are the two most common symptoms that should alert the medical practitioners to think of the possibility of iron deficiency state.
And let's zoom in on iron deficiency in children. What are some of the causes there, and what are some of the symptoms that might present?
I think sudden spurt of growth is usually the time when they start to complain. And the parents will notice the child being a bit more irritable, not coping at school, and not wanting to take part in sports-related activities. In other words, a general sense of unwellness or fatigue and not coping, or even the study performance can drop off a bit if they are lacking in iron. Particularly in that age group, the dietary thing also comes in. If they don't eat a well-balanced diet that includes red meat or iron-rich food items, then that can add to the problem of increased demand and not enough intake of iron. This will become more apparent to the parent, particularly in girls, as they attain menarche, 10, 11, 12, 13 years of age. They'll find the difference and they'll be concerned, and it's not uncommon for them to take the child to the doctor for that reason.
And let's turn to women in their reproductive years. How do they present, and what kind of investigations should be undertaken?
It's very similar. You know, the symptom of tiredness, fatigue, not coping with the demands of day-to-day life, whether it's at home, running a family, looking after the children, or at work. And many women these days in that age group are also working. So they'll struggle to cope with the demands, both at home and at work. Some people even say that they are not able to concentrate or think clearly to solve problems and so on. So it's a whole variety of symptoms, but the common thing, most common being tiredness, lethargy, and I'm not coping. So the practitioner will have a reasonable idea as to why this is happening when they take the history. The two important things would be the menstrual blood loss, whether it's normal or abnormal. If it is abnormal, is it just excessive bleeding over a 4 to 5 day period, or is that protracted bleeding for a longer period, or both? Secondly, to assess the dietary intake of iron, the common, most beneficial source is the red meat intake. So with these, they'll have a fair idea as to the likelihood of iron deficiency state. When the GP or the medical practitioner suspects iron deficiency state, they obviously will need to do some blood tests to confirm that they are on the right track. And the common test that most medical practitioners would do would include a full blood count and normal serum chemistry, liver function tests, and the serum iron studies. In terms of serum iron studies, it's always useful to do the full test, which includes serum iron level, total iron binding capacity or transferrin level, and iron saturation from these two, and serum ferritin. That will give them an idea as to what level of iron deficiency that the patient has. Not everybody will have anemia, but subtle changes in the serum iron studies will put them on the right track. In patients who are iron deficient, the first one to go down is the storage form of iron, namely serum ferritin. The second thing to show abnormality would be the serum iron saturation. That will be low, less than 10% or whatever the range is for the lab. And the third and the last is the hemoglobin level. In severe cases, you will have abnormalities in all three areas. The patient will be anemic, the iron saturation will be low, and the serum ferritin will be low. But in the milder degrees of iron deficiency state, you may not see anemia, and even the iron saturation may be normal, but the serum ferritin will be low. Even when the patient is not anemic, they can still have significant symptoms, you know, which kind of varies from patient to patient. So when they do the initial investigations, they will have a clear idea, A, that the patient certainly has iron deficiency state, and two, the degree of iron deficiency for them to address the problem.
And Professor Manoharan, what's the importance of getting to the bottom of a cause, making sure it's investigated before treatment begins?
As a general rule, it doesn't matter what age group I would recommend for the family practitioners, once they confirm iron deficiency, to get the patient back to go through with them. I think the key thing here is to ascertain the cause and have a clear understanding as to why the particular patient became iron deficient. I would suggest a few simple questions for them to systematically go through with each of those patients. Firstly, do they get enough iron from what they eat? And secondly, whether they have any abnormalities of their bowel motions, whether they have regular bowel habits or whether they have some gastrointestinal issues that may interfere with the absorption of iron. And then talk about excessive bleeding from any source. For example, when they talk about the bowel habits, have they noticed any blood, whether it is fresh or altered blood in the stools, to change the color of the poo, and also obviously the menstrual history. So when they diagnose iron deficiency state, they should go through these simple questions about dietary habits and bowel habits and menstrual history to have a clear understanding as to why this particular individual has become iron deficient before they talk about the therapeutic approach to deal with the problem. The practitioner should always make an effort to address that particular cause. Otherwise, the problem will keep coming back. So if, for example, they have excessive menstrual blood loss, they should simultaneously think about dealing with it. If need be, send the patient to a gynecologist to address that particular issue. So once they have that understanding, they have to make it a point to address and solve the underlying problem.
And Professor Manoharan, what is your approach in treating patients diagnosed with iron deficiency?
In terms of treatment, if the diet is very suboptimal and the degree of anemia is not severe, or as I said, they may not be on anemic, if it is only a borderline low iron status, it's always worthwhile to discuss the need to optimize the dietary source of iron before you consider putting them on iron supplementation therapy. It doesn't always work, but it's always worth going through that approach, particularly in people with borderline iron deficiency state. If the patient, for example, is a vegetarian and they don't want to change their habits, then obviously you have to look at the therapeutic options. And the simplest and quite effective option is oral iron supplementation therapy. There are a number of oral iron tablets. The most common ones are the two most commonly used ones are ferrous sulfate with or without vitamin C and iron polymaltose. If the patient is keen to go on to oral iron therapy, then start the patient on iron therapy.
And Professor Manoharan, if the patient goes on to take oral iron therapy, is there a certain time of day that works best? And also, what is the role of vitamin C here?
In this area, there have been some recent developments and better understanding as to how best to give the iron supplementation therapy to the patients. Until very recently, the common recommendation used to be take this iron tablet one every day, for example. Now we know better, and that is in fact not a good regimen. I'll come to that in a minute. In terms of the iron tablets, if the tablet has got vitamin C as part of the medication, then the patient can take it with just plain water. If it doesn't have vitamin C, if it's only plain ferrous sulfate, then they should be advised to take it with orange juice. The vitamin C bit increases the absorption of iron. The second point I would like to stress is the timing of the intake of the iron tablet. Ideally, it should be taken on an empty stomach 2 hours after a meal. If the patient has any problems for whatever reason, then it is okay for them to take it after a meal at night. The common practice of people being asked to take the iron in the morning is sometimes difficult because they have to take it on an empty stomach. The second more common problem is most people also have a cup of coffee or tea in the morning. Those two things can interfere with the absorption. So the advice should be not to drink any coffee or tea for 2 hours before and 2 hours after they take the iron tablet. So one of the pitfalls is when they take it in the morning, then the absorption is compromised. That's the reason why I say if they can't avoid drinking coffee or tea, it is okay for them to take it soon after dinner and either with orange juice, if it is plain iron, or if it is iron plus vitamin C, then to take it with water, it would still work.
And Professor Manoharan, what about dosing frequency? Do you have a specific recommendation?
So far, the general advice has been for them to take one tablet every day. And some practitioners mistakenly tell them to take even two tablets if the one doesn't work. The problem is the body has a funny way of reacting when you take iron. Once you take the iron tablet and the iron gets into the system and the serum iron level goes up, the liver produces an enzyme called hepcidine. It is an enzyme that controls the absorption of iron from the gut. So when the patient takes the iron tablet, the liver produces the hepcidine as a response or reaction. And this hepcidine blocks the absorption of iron the following day. So the iron tablet that the patient takes on day two doesn't get absorbed. And that iron stays in the gut. And that creates some of the common side effects of nausea and constipation, and in some patients, diarrhea. So for that reason, it is better to take the iron tablet intermittently. And the two common protocols, either the patient takes it on alternate days, so you trick the liver, the iron gets in the first day, no iron taken on day two, so the hepcidine level drops, take the iron on day three, iron gets in. So that's one way of tricking the liver and making sure that the iron is absorbed properly. Or some people say it's easier to take it on specific days. And I tell the patients to take it Monday, Wednesday, Friday. So they have specific days and they can't say, I don't know whether I took it yesterday or not. And either way, it works just as well as a daily schedule. In fact, it has the potential to work better, less side effects, because the side effects are one of the common reasons why patients become non-compliant.
And Professor, if the patient does not respond to the recommended oral iron, even with alternate day dosing, particularly in those patients with stubbornly low iron, what is your alternative approach?
If the patient is not responding to oral iron, or poor compliance or troublesome side effects, total dose iron infusion is now commonly practiced in people in various specialties, including gastroenterologists who investigate these patients either for malabsorption or bleeding history and so on. And hematologists obviously can do that. And some of the medical practitioners or family practitioners also have a setup to give total dose iron infusion. There are 4 or 5 different preparations for total dose iron, which is which includes iron polymaltose, ferric carboxymaltose, iron sucrose, iron dextran, and ferric derisomaltose. There are 4 or 5 different things, and different centers use different protocols. It is probably done under specific with specific protocols and good supervision, because some patients can have reactions or side effects from total dose iron infusion. One of the common things that the practitioners should be aware of is particularly with ferric carboxymaltose preparation, which is commonly used, hypophosphatemia is now recognized as a common problem. This is because it can happen with any of the other preparations, but it seems to happen much more commonly with the ferric carboxymaltose. This is because of increased phosphate excretion by the kidneys. So they develop hyperphosphaturia, resulting in hypophosphatemia. It can happen within a day of the patient receiving the infusion, and in some patients can last for up to 6 months. Interestingly, this particular complication does not happen in patients with renal impairment. So that's one group that seems to be protected from this common side effect.
And finally, Professor Manoharan, you have some take-home tips for our audience.
So now to wind up, three take-home messages that I want to stress on. One, iron deficiency anemia is not the complete diagnosis. Always ascertain the cause and make every effort to address it. Otherwise, the problem will keep coming back. The second take-home message is, if you're going to give oral iron therapy to the patient, advise them to take it either on alternate days or just three times a week, either on an empty stomach or 2 hours after a meal, or if the patient prefers for better compliance, they can still advise them to take it after dinner, but avoid drinking tea, coffee, or Coke for 2 hours before and 2 hours after. And thirdly, if you are considering parenteral iron therapy, the way to go is total dose iron infusion, which you can tailor the dose for the individual patient's needs, and make sure it happens at the centers that are familiar with the protocol, and be aware of the possibility of hypophosphatemia if you are using total dose iron infusion, particularly with ferric carboxymaltose.
Professor Arumugan Manoharan, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Sam. It was a pleasure.
Professor Manoharan is a specialist physician in clinical hematology at St George Private Hospital in Sydney and a clinical professor at the Graduate School of Medicine at the University of Wollongong. This podcast is sponsored by Viatris. You can find more podcasts on our website at mja.com.au or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening.